So yes, thank you very much, Ariadna, for the introduction and for inviting me. I've had a lovely afternoon. We've sort of done a little bit of walking and chatted, and it's been really nice being here already. And I felt really lovely, warm welcome when I arrived in the reception. So that was really nice. So thank you very much for inviting me and making it feel very comfortable being here already. So thank you. So yes, I know you've been doing the tantric series, and yes, Ariadna asked me to do the talk on the Wheel of Life, and I did say yeah, no, that's fine, no problems, fine. Although as the days and hours approached, I thought, oh, that's it's a big topic. It's a really very very big topic. So if you don't know, the Wheel of Life, just behind me here, is a traditional Tibetan symbol that's they might probably still have at the entrance of monasteries. And it's a reflective tool for reflection, as teaching aid as well, because it sort of holds lots of concepts, sort of some key Buddhist concepts in this image. And it's been used for generations, so it's a very sort of it's had a lot of practitioners pondering it over time. So yes, I thought it was fine to talk about it, but then I thought, talking about the Wheel of Life is like talking about is talking about life itself. This thing called life that we have. That we wake up in the morning, and then we go about our day, and then we go to sleep, and then in between waking and going to sleep, we have this thing called life, and then we have another type of life that happens when we're asleep. We don't always remember it or make sense of it, but it's still operating there. And then of course we have the life that happens when we're born. Obviously, that's the kind of, we sort of thrown into this thing called life. We come into consciousness at some stage and look around. I actually remember must have been about 3 years old, sort of looking around and going, this is, what is this and where am I? And, just actually pondering this thing. We're sort of thrust into life, and then we sort of continue, don't we, until at some point, we don't know when, it ends. And maybe another thing, from a Buddhist point of view, another process happens at that point, but we don't know what that is. So the Wheel of Life, this symbol, tries to capture all of that in different ways. I kind of thought, to talk about that then in 45 minutes or so is a tall order. So do that in a way that sort of brings, we know that life as it presents itself to us is very complex, it's rich, it has a lot of depth, there's lots of breadth, actually, and we only know our particular, part of that, let alone the whole way life manifests all around the world throughout time. So it's a big topic. So I would recommend you to go to Bante Sangharakshita's talk on the Wheel of Life. Actually, it's very comprehensive. He looks at lots of the themes, lots of concepts in it, and he really describes it sort of very vividly. So I would recommend you to that. Because I won't be going through all the concepts this evening. What I hope to do is just share some thoughts and reflections with you that I've had, and really, I guess, to stimulate your own interest and exploration in the Wheel of Life, and life as we ordinarily know it. So the first thing I did when I thought, right, I've got to start really seriously thinking about this now, is I thought, well, just look at the image. And Bante, one of the things that he says about the Wheel of Life is that it's a mirror. It's a mirror for us. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. It's a mirror, isn't it? So what do I do with mirrors? Well, I have my mirror at home. my actual mirror, and I stand in front of it, and reasonably regularly. What presents itself is just, you know, how I am at that moment. That sort of jumps out at you, or this is how I am at this moment. I don't always remember or don't reflect on the fact that I was very different 3 years ago, or 3 weeks, or 3 months ago, or 3 weeks ago. And I don't always imagine that I'm going to be very different 3 years hence, you know, 10 years hence. So that's not always there in my consciousness, although sometimes it might be. But so really what jumps out is what is right there happening now. So when I remember actually coming across the Wheel of Life probably about 20-odd years ago. And I remember when I looked at it the very first time, what jumped out at me was the monster. So you have a look at the wheel. Because a monster jumped out at me. I don't know if it's the obvious thing, firstly, that's there in the wheel. This monster, this demon, it's called Yama. Yama the demon. And jumps out. So it's kind of interesting because it's a Wheel of Life is like a mirror. I have my actual mirror where I look at myself, but then I have this internal mirror called the Wheel of Life. And I remembered when I first looked at it that Yama jumped out at me. But actually, it sort of jumped out at me and wanted me to pay attention. It sort of said, look, you know, pay attention. Listen, that's what it said. So we're going to this evening take a few looks at this wheel, and I sort of pointed you to Yama already. My first impression of Yama was pretty terrifying. It's sort of I don't know if anyone doesn't find it terrifying. It's sort of, he's holding the whole wheel in his jaws and its claws. And I remember thinking, I don't know if I want to look at that. That was my first impression. I don't know if I want to actually really look at this this monster, this demon. I felt I was being confronted with something, and I didn't actually know if I wanted that. So, yes, it is pretty frightening initially. The fact that it's holding the whole wheel, so this whole thing called life is happening here, and Yama is holding it, and it suggests that he's in control. It suggests that he's in total charge of everything that's happening within the sphere. So that's interesting, isn't it? Demon is in charge of us and the life that we have in some way. So I kind of think that's interesting. So monsters and demons, we've had them throughout time, haven't we? All cultures have their versions of the monster, if you like. And they represent our deepest fears and anxieties, our sort of insecurities. And they also represent death. They represent death. They represent annihilation, even. They represent some kind of terrible transformation, a transformation we don't know if we'll be able to survive. That's what demons really represent, and monsters. So Yama here stands for impermanence, for change. And we sort of know, I mean, all people throughout ages, poets and writers and philosophers and spiritual seekers, everybody sort of had to sort of think about, oh, life, it means change. You know, we know that. It's sort of woven into the fabric of our very existence, isn't it, change? So Yama represents the fact and truth of change and is our great, he's our sort of great ruler and teacher. And so from this ordinary perspective, we know we need change. That's how we grow. It's how we grow, it's how we thrive, it's how we develop things, you know, it's how we make the changes we want to make in our lives. It gives us that possibility. So we kind of know that in some ways we embrace change and impermanence because it facilitates our existence, the way we operate. But it is also deeply threatening to us, impermanence and change. It is also deeply frightening to us. So I was thinking, well, why is this? Well, I was thinking, well, in a way, from a young age, sort of talking about being thrust, you know, into life and remembering around three, thinking, okay, where am I? What is this? So we're sort of thrust into this thing called life, and then we become conscious of that at some point. And then it's kind of, life is about surviving. Life is about existing, surviving, trying to live and work out what that means. It's trying to, and then we go on a process, we go to school, we get educated, we're sort of learning, we're creating, we start building, we start imagining, we establish. These are all the things that we do. And then once we've sort of established anything, whether it's a friendship or, you know, we're kind of engaged in education, once we've established anything, then we're sort of trying to maintain. We're trying to maintain, secure, defend, shore up what it is we put our energies into. So, and that's in every aspect of life. So that's whether that's a home, relationships, you know, families, work, status, even our identity, our views. These are all things that we're engaged in trying to develop in some way. Our sort of participation in groups, in communities, even in countries, you know, we're all sort of engaged in this project. So that's how we know of life. That's what we think. All those aspects. That's what we think of as life. Well, it feels very worthwhile, doesn't it? We're sort of doing this thing, and that's sort of all we know, really. So that's all fine, but then, you know, impermanence, change means all of those things will pass, yeah? Will die away, will evolve and change in a way we don't necessarily have control over. And it's subject to change in ways we don't have control over and we can't foresee. So that is threatening. That is threatening to us. If we take that in, it is threatening to us. Because on the one hand, we're putting energy into creating and maintaining and developing, and at the same time, those very things that we're putting energy into are subject to change that we don't actually have ultimate control over. So yama represents the change that is unwelcome, really. It's a change that we don't want. We're all right. We think, actually, I want to change my house. I want to, you know, do this, or I want to get fit. You know, we're all right with that kind of thing, the things that we decide and we consciously engage in. We're not happy with, we're threatened by, the change is unwelcome. So yes, it represents that sort of, that sort of change we don't have control over. Ultimately, of course, it represents the change that we will go through with our very physical selves as well. You know, our physical selves will die. We'll go through a radical transformation that we can't imagine at this point. And the self, you know, our identification with the self also goes at that point or at some point. And again, we can't imagine that. We can't imagine not identifying with this physical self and this personality and this lifestyle and these connections that we have. So yeah, that's one of the reasons why impermanence, change, is deeply threatening to us. So, yes. So the question it presents, really, is how do we live? How do we go about our lives, then, in a way that sort of, where we can feel fulfilled and happy and that feels purposeful and meaningful, knowing that all those things will pass away at some point? How do we do that? So yama, I think he really stares, you know, you could say it's threatening, it is threatening from one point of view. It's also a huge challenge because he's staring down at us and with that question, really. So from our ordinary perspective, our sort of unenlightened perspective, yama threatens us, really. But with a much broader perspective, it's a challenge. He says, well, okay, How are you going to live this life knowing that it's all going to change? How are you going to do that? What's going to matter? What's going to be important? What are you going to prioritise? And it's a challenge, and it encourages us to wake up to that question, and to really note that, you know, well, in a way, I think if you wake up to that question, then you've got to do something about it. For me, at some point, I realised I had to do something about that question, about how I live, knowing that it wasn't going to last forever. So it also opens up a question, it opens up a mystery. You know, what is this thing that we call life, then, if it's so fleeting and will end? It opens up a really profound mystery, I think. A mystery that you can start engaging in really creatively, really positively, if you take in the truth of impermanence. So I don't know how many of you, you can put a show of hands actually, how many of you have sort of had dreams where you're being pursued by some being or some creature? At least half, if not more than half, I certainly have. And I find them, when I have these dreams, they're very visceral. I sort of, you know, I can wake up and I can feel my heart still going. It feels really real, like it's actually happened. And particularly if these dreams are recurring, then it gets... I remember having a series of dreams which were recurring, and, you know, in the end I just thought, I don't know if I want to go to bed, because I just know it's just going to be really hard work and just horrible. You know, so it can create quite a bit of anxiety when I was having them. So, yeah, very strong experiences of being pursued by some kind of creature or monster or being. But we know, and we keep running. That's the thing that happens in these dreams, particularly if they recur, and you just keep going. And at a certain point, hopefully, the psychologists tell us, and I know from my own experience, that what we need to do is to stop. Yeah? We need to stop running from what's pursuing us. But that stopping actually takes a lot of courage. It takes awareness, and it takes a lot of courage to say, actually, I don't think this is the answer. Well, it's not the answer, because you keep being pursued. So you're just going to keep running. So you know it's not the answer. But it takes some courage and awareness to go, okay, I need to stop. And then it takes another bit of courage to then be prepared to face the thing that's chasing you. So in my experience, sometimes a thing that's chasing me sometimes might vanish. Like, what was it? And other times, I take a very good look at it. And in a way, it's a sort of standoff somehow. You know, there's me, and there's a thing that's been pursuing me. And, well, we're looking at each other. It's really, I find it really fascinating, that sort of looking at the thing that you fear the most, or the thing that you've been running from. And what happens if you stay with the experience? What happens is that you sort of become a little bit familiar, at least with the look of this thing. Yeah, so you become a little bit familiar with it. And you begin to wonder about it. You begin to maybe even ask questions in your mind, you know, about it. You know, where's it come from? What does it want? Why is it here? Why does it look like the way it does? You know, you begin to ask a few questions. Perhaps it's also looking back at you. You know, perhaps you experience yourself being looked at by this thing. So what is it? What does it want from you? You know, what do you want? What do you need from this being? And what does it want from you? A dialogue even begins to happen between you and this demon, you and the thing that you've been running from. And even with the dialogue, maybe a connection. Maybe within that somehow or other, it loses its power, doesn't it? That's what happens. The thing that you've been running from loses its power to control you, actually. Because there's now a dialogue, there's now a connection, there's now a bit of familiarity, even a relationship, even maybe seeing that there's there's things that you might even have in common, or there's things that maybe you're not as separate from it as you thought you were. So I think that's all very fascinating. And actually, impermanence works in the same way, sort of turning towards it, looking at it, getting familiar, you know, with it, the thing that, what is it that frightens us about impermanence? So Yama encourages us, even though at the beginning we might not really want to look, Yama encourages us to just to keep looking and become familiar with what it is we feel, and actually begin to see the connection between us and this being. Okay, so let's have another look at this wheel. So when I did that, interesting actually, my eyes went straight to the middle of the very centre of the wheel. So where we have a cockerel, a snake and a pig, and they're all biting each other, sort of all interlinked. So they represent greed, hatred and delusion, ignorance. And it's said that the whole of our ordinary life and ourselves is driven by greed, hatred and delusion. So that's said quite sort of straightforwardly, yeah. How many of us actually think that's true? You think that's true, Sanger, don't you? You would. How many of you think, actually, I'm not sure? No one's? Okay. Because I feel like, I put my hand up. If somebody asked me a question, I would put my hand up and say, yes, that's true, yes. We're driven by greed, hate, and delusion. I'll do exactly the same. And at times, I'm thinking, there's so many good things, isn't there, about life and about me? You know, I'm definitely not all of that. Definitely not all of that. There's so many positive things that go on in the world. So many, you know, well, just, I mean, in a way, the world is full of joy, isn't it? I certainly can be positive some of the time, at least. So in that sense, I'm thinking, well, it's kind of a, this is not the whole picture. This is not the whole picture. However, Bhante is quite interesting because he says, actually, what that also points to is not necessarily, yes, it points to that, you know, that's the life, samsara, if you like, is driven by those three things. But it also points to our animal nature. And I quite like that he said that. So, it points to the fact that we have an animal nature. And how do we work with that? What does that mean for us as human beings? So I thought, well, what do animals do? You know, what's their features? So I'll sort of give a few, and then you might have one or two I might have missed out. So I've got, well, certainly they've got this instinct to survive, yes? And we know that. It's a very strong survival instinct all animals have. And they're dominated by that instinct, I understand. So much of their time and energy is focused on the things that, you know they need to survive. So food, sex, reproduction, sleep. That dominates their existence. They also identify, animals, they identify deeply with other species. Yeah, they sort of go around together in groups, don't they, in various types of configurations, depending on their particular species. And they also depend on the group for their survival. They're territorial, so they'll fight for territory, and they'll fight for resources as well. And they have a strong hierarchy as well in the animal world. So very strong hierarchy, and they dominate or are dominated by, it seems. So those are my reflections on animal nature. Anything I've missed out? Anything obvious that I've missed out there? Is that it? Sorry?
I mean, it's hard to generalise, isn't it? Because there's a gradation of animals.
Yes, yes.
I'm thinking of some very moving footage of, well, the fact that certain species animals definitely feel grief.
Yes, yeah.
The loss of other members of the species.
Yes,
yes. The collective response to that.
Yes. No, that's right. So I think there's we're not saying they've not got consciousness in some way or some other things, because I think you're right. I think I've definitely... I looked after two cats, actually. I'm not really a pet. I don't know if I had pets, really, but I looked after two cats, and I could see their relationship and the sort of connection they had, with each other. And it was very moving. There's different species of animals, and they say they've got different levels of consciousness. And certainly some animals exhibit, it seems, certainly from our point of view, some things that we recognise as also human kind of qualities, like connection in some way, or grief, as you're describing. But that list is a kind of generic, would you say, sort of generic territorial instinct to survive, dominating, focus on needs, basic needs, yeah? So I actually thought, when I was thinking about this, well, I don't know why war came to mind. And I thought, actually, if I think about some of the wars, at least, that are going on or have gone on, they've been motivated by some of those things. Territory, yeah, and fighting for resources. Identification with groups, people that are similar. What else? Dominance, yeah? Desire to dominate or be dominated by. So I thought, actually, a lot of the conflict that we have stem from those sort of very basic animal sort of instincts, if you like, which I thought was quite interesting. We rationalise, though, don't we? That's a thing, sort of if there's a conflict between two countries, there's a lot of rationalisation and politics that go into that. But actually, what the real reason is, often I think it's one of those. So that was interesting. We actually share a lot of, animals may share some things with us as human beings, and we certainly share animal arts or animal nature. And we do rationalise, we have that ability to rationalise. But it's quite interesting if you've got into an argument recently or, flown into a rage or really desperately wanted something and didn't get it, then it's kind of interesting, isn't it, to see, well, what is it? Is it my nature? Is it my sort of animal nature there sort of exhibiting itself? Interesting just to ask oneself that. We have the ability to not be exclusively dominated by our basic instincts. That's what we do know. So that takes us to our third look in the mirror. So I want to point you to this bit here, the circle, the sort of the dark and the light circle there that surrounds the animals. So, yes, we have the ability to reflect on our actions and choose how to respond as a result. So this light and this dark. So you've got sort of people falling in the dark. They're falling downwards. And you've got people sort of ascending in this light. In some wheel of life, they're all connected as well in some of the images too. So I really when I first saw this image Wheel of Life years ago, I remember thinking, I recognise this circle. And it was partly because when I was 14 years old, I got into trouble at school and I was excluded for a few days or suspended or whatever they call it. I had such sort of sense of injustice. I felt it was really unjust, what had happened to me. Because I understood, why the various incident happened and it wasn't fair. And I felt, that was an unjust decision. But there I was at home having to, be be by myself, really, for a few days and not go to school. And I think my mum was away as well, so I had the house to myself. So it was a bit sort of like I really had to reflect. That's what I had to do. I had to reflect. And I sort of didn't know what to do because I thought, it's unjust what's happened. I'm not happy. At the same time, I could also see that it was anger that had got me into the situation in the first place. And I thought, what do I do? If I go back to school being angry, the situation's going to continue. I could see that it would just escalate. And I was already unhappy because I was unhappy with the whole thing. I was already unhappy and I thought, I can see that's going to make me unhappier. And then this kind of image really did occur where it was like, well, there's two paths. There's two paths I can take. There's a positive path where I can try and be positive and not follow my anger. And this other path where I can be, or I can just follow, really, and go back to school and be, rage, basically. And I could see, it was like a light and a dark path before me. And I just thought, well, what do I want to do? What should I do? And at that point, I did decide. I thought, well, I know I'm unhappy now. I don't want to become more unhappy. It was as simple as that, actually. I don't want to become more unhappy. I've got to solve things. I don't know how yet, but I know that being angry, following that, is not going to help. So I chose to go back to and learn how to engage with the situation more positively, more creatively. So in a way, well, I was really pleased when I saw this. Cause I thought, oh, that's kind of what I did. There was this choice, basically, between two paths, and there it was. Although, it's interesting that even though I made that choice at that point, I still had lots of problems. I still got into difficulties. I had much more awareness about them now. That was a thing. And I knew I had a choice. But the problem still did happen. And that was because, well, there's still greed, hatred and delusion. They're still there. They're still operating in my experience. So whilst this circle represents for us, really it represents our ability to be ethical, to kind of make conscious choices. It doesn't, although it represents that, it doesn't actually give us freedom from the whole wheel itself. Different conditions will happen, different factors arise, and anger, greed, hatred, and delusion will still emerge. And then, obviously, then we choose how to respond. Yeah. So it's not enough. It's not enough to be good, basically. We need more than that. So let's have another look at this. What am I going to now? So now we come on to the main part, if you like, or at least the part that takes up a lot of the wheel, which is the six realms. And I found these really fascinating, these six realms. They actually represent six different worlds. And I do think, actually, I think this is one of the bits of the wheel as a mirror that come to me quite relatively regularly. I'll be in a situation, or I'll hear about a situation, and I will go, oh, that's that realm, that's that world, that's that mindset. So there are six different worlds, and in Tibetan Buddhism, they actually, they think the worlds do exist. Certainly we know there's an animal realm, we know that, there's a human realm, and the others they also think are existent, apparently. And it's said that you can then be reborn into these realms, these worlds, depending on your karma, depending on your previous actions. So Bante talks about these a bit more in terms of our psychological sort of states, our sort of mindsets, mental states, and how our mental states deeply inform or colour our experience, colour the world that we're in. So I'll tell you what they're like: the hell realm, the god realm, the human realm, the animal realm, one called Ashra realm, which is a highly competitive, polarised realm, and there's a realm of hungry ghosts. And each realm has a Buddha standing in there with an implement, giving us the teaching that we need in that realm. So I actually thought, okay, I just sort of looked over my last 10 days or so and thought, okay, what do I see according to these realms? What pictures came to mind? And it's things that I've personally engaged in or heard about or seen in the news or witnessed in some way. So picture this. 10 men and one woman are convicted for modern day slavery. They've been convicted for picking up homeless men and women, mostly men, some with mental health problems, to work long days without pay or access to sanitary conditions. The victims lived in fear throughout and thought there was no opportunity to escape, and they've suffered deeply and are traumatised. So that's a hell, yeah? That's a kind of hell realm there for those victims, and even for the people that are engaged in doing that, it's a hell realm. We could have swapped that with any other scene, really. I mean, that was a newspaper report I read, but we could have swapped that with Charlottesville, what's going on in America at the moment with the race riots. We could have swapped that with the migrant boats and detention centres, or boats being turned back to places of war. So we could have swapped them with many, many stories in the media. So yes, from a personal point of view, that's sort of out there in the world. Personal point of view, hell represents, could represent intense loss, grief. It could represent deep rage. It could represent trauma as a result of, events happening suddenly. It could represent ongoing despair. Hell could represent all those things, emotional breakdown. So no one wants to be there. No one wants to be in hell. It's a place of intense suffering, and one that you're not sure if there's a way out. When you're in it, you can't. It's very hard to see what the way out is. And the Buddha is standing there in that realm, and he's pouring amrita, nectar, into the mouths of these beings. And this amrita, this nectar, is deeply nourishing, it's deeply healing, and it gives these beings respite from suffering. So if you're in states of intense suffering, you, and really sometimes on a very basic level, you just need looking after. You know, like if you're, say, in grief, in intense grief, you know, so somebody bringing food and just making sure practical things are done, those things really do help. So you just need some respite often from those things. So that's what amrita represents initially. And amrita also represents enlightenment. So, because when we hit rock bottom, when we hit rock bottom, we sometimes look up. We look for a way out. We look to escape from where we've arrived at. And we're really desperate for answers. We really want to seek an answer to the situation we're in. So there's quite a bit of energy, actually, if you're in that kind of state at times. So amrita represents nectar, healing, nourishment, also represents enlightenment. Because we want answers at that point. We really do need answers. We want them. Okay, so picture this. I'm walking down a country lane. People are smiling as I pass. There's smell of flowers in the air. There's blackberry bushes ripe and ready to be picked. The sun is shining, it's a deep blue sky, the silence and stillness, there's a feeling of complete peace and contentment. Nothing is needed, nothing is sought, all feels complete. So that was me on my recent solitary in Somerset. I could have been in Antigua, that's my real God realm where I'm from. So that's where I, you know, I'm on the beach a lot, and waves and the sea and lots of tropical fruits and a very lush environment. So that's my absolute God realm. So yes, we're in the realm of gods now. And it's also the realm of dhyana and meditation and higher states of consciousness as well. So I just think, great. I sort of think it's to me, I think, you know, it's wonderful. I do love God realms. And I think actually it's enjoyable, it's restorative. You know, if you've had a hard time, you've been, you know, things are going on, actually having some time in a really pleasant environment with positive things around, accessing, where you're able to access positive mental states. I mean, it just changes your outlook on life. It gives you energy. You can go back into your world ready, you know, to meet the world. So I'm a fan of God realms. And I just think, well, what's the problem, really? Any ideas? What's the problem there?
It's not permanent.
Oh, right, yes. Which we forget, you know, it's not permanent. And because we forget, and also, if you're in a realm like this for a long time, and some people do, you know, it might be even some of you, live like this, actually ongoingly, sort of, you know, you get sort of, they say celebrities and various people, you know, who can get everything they want, it seems, when they want it, it seems, from the outside anyway, looking in. Glamorous life, let's say, where there's no real hardship. So some people do have that kind of existence. Sometimes it's just because you're healthy, you're well, you're really positive, nothing terrible's ever happened to you or anyone else around you. You know, that's all great, isn't it? And it doesn't last forever. It doesn't last forever. And I think, and also what happens with that is that when it does end, it's a shock. It's a real shock. And we haven't actually necessarily developed the resources to be able to respond to that end. And that's difficult. That's very, very painful. Also, I think, I wonder, it can lead to complacency. So when you're in it, you think, this is great, you know. It's not going to end, and then when it does, it's a real shock. But also, I'm wondering about pride as well, because I think sometimes we identify, well, this is me. If this is my life, then it must reflect on me and my character, my personality. I must be a really good person if this is my life. Actually, it could be your life because just lots of conditions have come into being. And what would you be like without those conditions? So complacency and maybe a bit of pride can come in there. So the Buddha stands there. Oh, he's playing the lute. That's it. The Buddha's playing the lute of impermanence. Because if you're in such a pleasurable state, you don't really want to know anything about change and impermanence. You want to keep the pleasure going. So actually what you will do is listen to music. You'll listen to beautiful music. It's just enhancing your pleasurable experience. And so the Buddha knows that to play music, but teach that just somehow the message, the teaching of impermanence just seeps into consciousness. And then you're able to receive it. Yeah. So that's the God realm. Picture this. I'm walking down a high street. I'm noticing the betting shop. I'm looking in. There's blank, glum faces staring at screens, waiting for something to happen. Very little does, I'm told. They are back again the next day. So that's a betting shop. In some areas in London, there's loads of them, like three or four on one street. I do watch people going in and then coming out, and I do wonder what their experience is. But it's also the realm of internet shopping, or internet, the internet, surfing the internet, shopping when we're upset, eating when we're not hungry. It's the realm of, what else? Oh, there's loads of forms of it, isn't there, really? Lots of forms of little addictions. So we're now in the realm of the hungry ghost, where we have needs and they're unmet, and we're trying to meet those needs in ways that can't meet those needs. Yes, So it's the realm of neurotic craving. It's a realm of addiction. It's a realm of ongoing dissatisfaction, but desperately trying to meet that to be satisfied. So although we try and meet it, so the shopping might work for a bit, but then the thing that we're upset about is still there, and it will just that the desire then manifests a different way, or the upset manifests a different way. So yes, trying to meet our needs, our desires in ways that can't really satisfy. And traditionally, this realm is represented by beings with these huge extended bellies. So these big bellies, large eyes, tiny mouths, and tiny necks and throats. So, and everything they try to consume, so they're desperately hungry, and they want to be fed. And they try to consume these things, but it turns to fire. They cannot take in, absorb anything. So, so the Buddha, in this, what do you think the Buddha would give here? Any ideas?
Sustenance,
yeah. They're hungry. They're really hungry. And so they need to be fed, but they need to be fed with something that actually can nourish them. Yeah, they need to be fed with something they can absorb, take in, and nourish them. So in this realm, when we're in this kind of state, it's thinking about what is it? What is it that I really need? Yeah, here? And what is the best sustainable, most nourishing way, most creative way to fulfill that? Picture this. Two political leaders threatening to attack each other, declaring to the world and to each other how powerful their weapons are and how they could, if they choose, destroy each other. I won't mention any names there. So that's the realms of the Asuras there. So it's a competitive, powerful, polarized state where beings in that state, they want to be superior, they want to win, and they want to be top dog, really. And that could be any, I mean, the world's out there, politics is a good place for that, celebrities' life maybe. Business and finance, yeah. Really, any world where status, money, power, looks even, yeah, how you look can be a factor. Popularity, where popularity matters. Any world like that, we could be in the realm of the Asuras. So yes. And again, it can really colour our experience and certainly completely affect how we relate to another human being. So it is a tendency we all have. We want to be popular, we want to be praised sometimes. And it's kind of interesting, where's that coming from? Where's that coming from? So the Buddha in this realm gives us a sword. And it's a sword of enlightenment, because the idea is there's a lot of energy behind this desire, the desire to compete, to be top dog, to be superior to others in whatever way. There's a lot of energy there, and there's a ability to actually to win. There's a kind of a mindset of winning overcoming. So the Buddha gives beings in this realm the sword of enlightenment. Yeah? Because actually, what is the biggest challenge? If you really want to conquer something, what is the biggest thing you can conquer? It's our own mind, it's our own greed, our own hatred, our own ignorance. That is the biggest contest you're going to have. And it's a challenge that's going to be, if you take up that challenge, if you have that energy and direct it towards the challenge of really understanding oneself and one's heart and conquering the poisons, those three poisons, if you really take up that challenge, it will be of benefit to you and others. And that paradigm, that sort of that paradigm of powerful and powerless, the superior and inferior, the aggressor, the owned and owned, all those sort of things that are completely polarized, yeah. That world, that way of looking at the world, completely diminishes. The more you engage with overcoming your own sort of greed, hatred, and delusion, those sort of polarized way of experiencing the world begins to diminish. And instead of that sort of polarized world, there's victim, there's aggressor, powerful, powerless. What we're experiencing more is our interconnectedness, our sense of if I'm doing something that benefits for me, it benefits for you. If I'm benefiting you, it's benefiting me and many, many other people. That separation begins to dissolve. Okay, so we've talked about the animal realm already a little bit. We do know it exists, it's real. Survival, meeting basic needs, those are sort of generic animal traits. So there's a whole realm there. And here, the Buddha gives a book. It represents culture. It is through culture, I was thinking about this, that actually it's through education. Education is so important, isn't it? Sort of very early education is really important. Because it's there where we begin to see other ways of experiencing the world. We begin to imagine. We begin to empathise with others. And through culture in all its forms, we begin to realise actually life is very rich. We're more to us than just our meeting our basic needs. There's more to humanity. I've been actually studying a bit of history recently. It's been really interesting. I'm thinking, gosh, people in the Middle Ages, I don't know why I sort of thought, but people in the Middle Ages, they had similar problems to us now. And just seeing how cultures evolved and changed, yes, and at the same time there's some sort of real basic things that are very similar. It's been quite interesting. So culture really opens our eyes up to who we are as human beings and enriches our experiences. Okay, picture this. A huge sports stadium, the hotly anticipated race, the hero of athletics is running with his team. And so is a team from the country where the stadium is based. The race starts and there's a huge roar in the stadium and people are on their feet cheering. It's a really tight race. There are just a few more metres to go. They are almost neck and neck, and the hero now has a baton. So it's a relay, so the hero has the baton. There's a huge roar as he takes up the baton. He's running down the home straight, and then he falters. He falters, he grabs his leg, he grimaces, and he falls to the ground. The roar subsides just for a moment. Falters, well, there's a moan even along with him. But then the team from the host team, people notice, are actually heading near the winning line. And so the roar picks up again and it changes into this huge cheering as their team wins. The cameras televising this event don't know where to place themselves. They're there on the winning team, cheering, you're running around the track, the crowds are cheering, but then they span to the fallen hero, who's grabbing his leg in agony, the wheelchair next to him, and then they span back again to the cheering crowds and to the people running around celebrating. And the commentators are reflecting that up and down. They're also, you know, saying how amazing it is that this team has never won a championship medal, and there they are now, the winners with an amazing time. And then they span back to the hero. Said, "How terrible! What a terrible shame he's ended his career in this way." And then they reflect: nothing lasts forever, even for this hero, even for the, you know, the person who was unbeaten, so powerful, triumphant, There he is now. Nothing lasts forever. So that's the human realm that we're in. And it is this juxtaposition between happiness, joy, and suffering that we have in the human realm. And it's this coming together of those things, the ability to, well, the experience of having positive and then having negative, to have joy, a sense of, you know, real, oh, isn't this world amazing, incredible, and then be at the depths of despair, it's that ability that actually forces us, stimulates us to reflect. What is this about? What is this world that we're in about? So the human realm is a very, very positive place to be because it's helping us to look deeper there. So the Buddha in this realm, he is holding a begging bowl, and it symbolises the quest of the seeker. Because when you have a scene like that in front of you, you have to ask questions. I mean, you could get carried away. You could get carried away by the joy, of course. But you can't ignore the fallen hero either. So it sort of it forces you to ask some deeper questions. And that's what the Buddha represents here with the bowl. Go out and ask these questions of yourself and of life. So these are our six realms. And how I use this, well, in a way, it's kind of like, well, what is, you know, what's my, where do I predominantly abide? Where do I predominantly abide? Where am I abiding now? So I might have a place I predominantly abide, but, you know, it changes. So where am I predominantly at? Where am I right now? And what is then the opportunity for me? Because each of these realms represent an opportunity. For freedom, actually, for learning, for understanding, for freedom. So yes, we've all probably had stays in these in some way at some time, to different degrees. So yes, the offer is to kind of, next time you're in that realm, how do we make the most of it? Even if it's deeply unpleasant, even if it's the hell realm, how do we make the most of this experience? What is our teaching that wants to present itself to us? What do we have to look at? So yes, the wheel is this amazing mirror, I think. It's this fantastic mirror that helps us understand the life we're living. I think it's also quite practical, really, because, you know, the Buddhas are there in the different realms, giving you, pointing you to what it is you need to do. So I think it's actually quite a practical tool as well. It certainly wakes us up, and it points us to where transformation can happen. Ultimately, though, we want to be free of this wheel. Ultimately, that's what we want, this endless going around. We want to no longer fear impermanence, yama. But I think for that, we do have to engage in the life that we have. We have to really, look at our natures, look at the mental states that we operate in, and how they then colour and influence the world we create. So, and also we begin to see how all the different conditions and, you know, sort of come into being also, you know, then impact on us and our experience. So, yes, this wheel goes very well with another image, another symbol called the spiral. So they really go well together. So I hope you will look at that, or if you've not done so already. Because actually the spiral represents a sort of much more upward moving, progressive, creative, ongoingly creative way of being. And the wheel, we're just going round and round and round. And I think the more we do learn to navigate, understand, transform, see ourselves in this way, in a way that it becomes a familiar thing, doesn't it? Sort of being in any of those realms become more familiar to us. We're less frightened by it, even though it might be deeply challenging still. We're less frightened by it. We kind of know what it is we need. We might take a bit of time to reach towards it, but we know what it is we need, And somehow the wheel no longer has the same hold, if you like, over us. And also, it gives us, I think, the more we can engage with the wheel, the more energy somehow, momentum we have to go up the, to go along to the spiral. Because yeah, it doesn't hold us in the way it does, in the way it did. Yeah, we're sort of freer to go up this much more progressive, creative condition, set of conditions. So yes, I sort of want to end really with thinking about that, thinking about the need to engage with our lives as it is. It's not about escaping the wheel in the sense of I can't deal with the wheel. It's much more around how do we learn to deal with our basic natures, our mindsets, the way we colour the world. How do we do that? What is the thing that we need to learn so that actually we can be free of the will? So yes, ultimately we're looking for freedom, and we're looking for wisdom, and we're looking for a love, really, that sort of embraces, that's all embracing, I would say. And that's in enlightenment. So yeah, I think that's all I want to say for now. Thank you.